and cold as the night wore on, until the first slivers of sunlight snaked through the clouded eastern sky. Finally, the last of his strength seeped away, and his hands lost purchase on the wreckage. He lay back as the swell carried him off, waiting for the sea to claim him, and staring up at the dimly lit clouds. Then blinked as a large black shape soared into view, folded its wings, and dived down towards him, claws extending. Katarius, Cirrus thought, as the red plucked him from the water and beat his wings to strike out on a westward course. Before Cirrus slipped into unconsciousness, he entertained the notion that the drake had found him hours before, but delayed his rescue, curious to see how long he would last. His new flagship was a diminutive mail carrier, recently renamed the Fallen Stock. She had a single paddle at the stern, driven by the most recent mark of steam engine. Cirrus recalled from the inventory provided by Veilmist, the island girl turned mathematical genius, that this craft was the fastest civilian vessel they possessed. It seemed he had Kathleen to thank for ordering the mail carrier to follow the ill-fated battle fleet as added insurance. Katarius had dumped his inert form on the foredeck before taking perch on the small ship's bridge house. The drake's weight was sufficient to buckle the ceiling and cause the ship to dip several inches. Cirrus spent a day in delirious slumber below decks, being fed broth by his spoiled crewmates, until he returned to full consciousness. Once again he found himself marveling at the fortitude of his remade body. An ordeal that would certainly have killed his human form was now little more than a day-long inconvenience.
"Welcome back, Admiral,"
Kathleen's thoughts greeted him when he made his way to the bridge the following morning.
"May I say how gratified I am by your survival, sir? This whole enterprise would be much less entertaining without you."
"You do me too much credit, miss," he replied. "My orders?"
"Sadly, it seems your mighty efforts proved in vain."
She pushed a vision into his head. It showed an eye-level view of the sea, the waves swept by gusts of thick smoke. The vision kept fading to grey before springing back into clarity, from which Cirrus deduced it had been captured by an injured spoiled near the point of exhaustion.
"There,"
Kathleen said, freezing the memory and dispelling any extraneous detail to focus on a vague shape in the smoke. Spoiled eyes were capable of capturing much more detail than human vision, so even through the haze, it was possible to discern the shape of a lifeboat. Kathleen magnified the image, revealing the slim form of a woman seated at the stern of the boat.
"Lizanne Lethbridge,"
Cirrus commented, stoking his fear to conceal the twinge of admiration for the woman's resourcefulness.
"Isn't she just so appallingly aggravating?"
Kathleen replied.
"The poor fellow who saw this didn't last much longer, I'm afraid. But it seems the boat was heading west. It's possible the sea may claim her before she finds rescue, but I doubt our luck is that good. Follow her, my dear, faithful Admiral. Find out her destination, then await us. We are coming, all of us."
Chapter 9. Lizanne.
"What is that?"
Macario said, peering at the western horizon. Lizanne followed his gaze, regretting the lack of green to enhance her vision. Spending the better part of 2 days in this lifeboat with no provisions or product had left them all in a state of chilled lethargy, apart from Sophia Griffin, who maintained the same rigid and silent posture throughout. Lizanne found her vision blurring as she tried to focus on the small speck in the distance, hoping not to discern the flap of wings as it drew nearer. However, it was Tinkerer who solved the mystery.
"An aerostat,"
he said, his brow furrowed as if trying to recall something out of reach.
"I don't know how I know that."
"The artisan knew it,"
Lazan said. It seems not everything is locked away after all. It took an hour for the aerostat to draw close enough for Lazan to make out its two occupants. A diminutive figure sat in front, manning what Lazan assumed were the contraption's controls, whilst a person of considerably bulkier proportions tended to what appeared to be some kind of flaming brazier, situated in the middle of the gondola.
A caloric oil burner, Tinkerer observed. Hot air is a reasonable alternative to a chemical lifting agent, though the design is crude.
I'd advise strongly against telling him that, Lazan said. She waved her arms as the aerostat slowed to an uneven hover 100 feet above. The propeller on the single engine at the stern spun fast enough to blur its blades, but seemed to be having difficulty making headway against the prevailing westerly winds. She saw Jeremiah lean over the side of the gondola and drop something. It splashed into the water a few feet shy of the lifeboat's bows, where it bobbed on the surface, until Macario retrieved it with one of the oars. It was a tarpaulin sack rigged with floats, quickly opened to reveal a large flask of water, some loaves and cured ham, and, to Lazan's great relief, one small vial of green. She looked up as Jeremiah shouted something from above, the words mostly swamped by the noise of the engine and the wind, but she was sure she caught the word, back. She saw Tekela give a wave, before returning her hands to the controls, whereupon the aerostat turned about and flew off towards the west. It seemed to Lazan that its departure had been much swifter than its approach.
Couldn't they have taken us with them?
Macario asked around a mouthful of bread. Lazan had noted that his usual decorum and refined accent had slipped somewhat during their time in the boat.
I doubt it can lift more than 2 persons at a time, Tinkerer replied,
eyes locked on the receding craft and head presumably filling with numerous design improvements. Lazan wondered if her father would welcome the artificer's input and found herself doubting it, though the prospect of their meeting did fill her with a certain guilty anticipation. She retrieved the flask of green from the sack and sat beside Sophia. Removing the stopper, she held the flask up to the woman's nose in the hope the scent of product might provoke her into some kind of animation. Instead, she was rewarded with only a small nose wrinkle.
Drink, Lazan said. It'll restore you.
That drew a response, Sophia turning her head to regard Lazan with a vacant stare.
Can you restore my husband, Miss Lethbridge?
She asked, her tone light and conversational.
The father to the child I carry. Can you restore him?
Lazan saw it then, the way the woman's hands were clasped over her belly in a tight protective shield.
Emperor's balls, Macario muttered. Just what we need.
He fell silent as Lazan shot him a warning glare.
No,
she said, turning back to Sophia.
I cannot.
She reached out to prise the woman's hands apart, placing the vial in her palm.
But I can keep you both alive. Don't you think he would want that?
Sophia stared at the vial in her hand, then put it to her lips and took a small sip. Lazan taking some gratification from the faint color she saw blossom in the woman's cheeks.
So what now?
Macario asked.
We eat,
Lazan said, reaching for the sack again.
And await rescue.
It may have escaped your notice, miss, Captain Trumaine said. But since Captain Varix and Director Thriftmore can no longer be counted amongst the living, command responsibility for this fleet now rests with me. I'll thank you to leave decisions regarding our course in my hands.
They were alone in his cabin, Lazan having been granted an interview only after the most strenuous insistence. Captain Trumaine, it seemed, had none of Captain Varix's pragmatism when it came to advice offered by an exceptional initiatives agent. Lazan hadn't been offered a seat, but took one anyway, slumping into the chair opposite the captain's desk and running a weary hand over her forehead.
It had taken 3 hours for the viable opportunity to appear and rescue them, and most of that time had been taken up with coaxing Sophia into eating something. She was in the care of the ship's doctor now, a highly capable and affable man named Weygrand, as Anne recalled from some of Clay's memories. Glancing up at Trumaine's arch, imperious visage above his steepled fingers, she couldn't help but wish events had conspired to keep this man in a comatose state, which would have placed the good doctor next in line for command. "As a matter of professional courtesy," she began, with all the politeness she could muster, "what is our present destination?" She saw Trumaine's face twitch in an unconscious expression of discomfort. It was probably some effect of his prolonged coma, and it told her a great deal. "Wherever we're going, he's not happy about it."
"Given our current fuel stocks, not to mention the supply situation," Trumaine replied, "there is only one viable course."
His face twitched again, and he let out a small cough before continuing.
"Verestia," he said. "Specifically, the Red Tides."
Lizanne stared at him, her lips curling as she contained an incredulous laugh.
"I know only a little of your career, Captain," she said, "so please correct me if my memory plays me false. Is it not the case that for most of your active service, you've been engaged in anti-piracy operations?"
Trumaine coughed again.
"Quite correct."
"So it would be a fair assumption that your name and reputation will be well known amongst piratical circles?"
"A fair assumption indeed."
"Then please explain to me why sailing into the most pirate-infested region in the world, at the head of an unarmed fleet of civilian vessels, is such a good idea?"
"There is nowhere else!"
Trumaine slammed his hands onto the desk, face twitching with renewed intensity. He glared at Lizanne for a long moment before composing himself, leaning back and straightening his uniform as he added,
"Not unless you think it wise we try our luck in a South Corventine port."
This was a point Lizanne was forced to concede. There was little prospect of finding safe harbor in one of the ports on the southern Corventine coast. The region was a hotbed of Imperial loyalists, and the chaos caused by the as-yet incomplete revolution would surely make for a hostile reception from the local authorities. But the welcome they would receive in Verestian waters might well be worse.
"The Viable is the only warship in the fleet," she said. "Even with 2 Bloodblessed on board to fire the engine and augment the defenses, it won't be able to protect every ship from seizure by pirates."
"Not all Verestians are pirates," Trumaine replied, "though they do tend to be universally greedy. They formed a government of sorts after the Empire lost control of the region, the seat of which is located at the Seven Walls. We will sail there and seek asylum in return for suitable compensation from the Iron Ship Syndicate."
"The Seven Walls sits at the heart of the Red Tides," Lizanne pointed out. "That's a considerable distance to cover without drawing unwelcome attention, regardless of what agreement we might want to make."
Trumaine's brow furrowed as he spent a moment in silent calculation, before his expression brightened fractionally.
"Then we have your esteemed father to thank for providing the means of sending an advance party," he said,
the first smile Lizanne had seen him make appearing on his twitching face.
"Miss Lethbridge, please do not worry that I might dissuade you from volunteering for such a mission. I feel that keeping you cooped up aboard ship would be a singular waste of your talents."
"It's supposed to have a frame."
Lizanne smothered a laugh as she watched Tinkerer unceremoniously pluck the pencil from her father's hand and begin sketching lines on his blueprint. From the look on the professor's face, she deduced he was simply too shocked to voice an objection.
"A rigid envelope allows for more capacity and durability,"
Tinkerer went on, the pencil moving in swift, precise strokes across the diagram.
and stronger fabric. Silk is far too fragile.
He stopped drawing and stepped back, turning to regard her father's rapidly darkening countenance.
And why?
Professor Lethbridge began, voice possessed of a distinct quaver.
Should I take any advice from the likes of... Three concentric rings connected by diagonal crossbeams.
Jemiah broke in, lips pursed as he surveyed the altered blueprint.
You know, that might actually work, Professor.
He raised an eyebrow at Tinkerer.
Materials? In the absence of a bespoke composite alloy, hollow copper tubing would be the best substitute.
Professor Lethbridge gave a snort, but, Lizanne noted, failed to voice any further objections, as Tinkerer went on to make additional modifications to the design for an improved aerostat.
The control surfaces are too small. Increased lifting capacity will allow for the addition of a second engine.
Lizanne left them to it, deciding to check on Macario's progress with the solograph. Captain Tremaine had ordered a good-sized portion of the viable's hold cleared for use as a makeshift workshop. This included a curtained-off section, where the musician had some measure of privacy, whilst he attempted to decipher the device's musical mysteries. It sat on the workbench, its various cogs and wheels gleaming in the lamplight. During the siege of Carvenport, they had taken the first steps to unlocking a few of its secrets, such as the fact that it was powered by music, or kinetic resonance, as Jemiah termed it. However, to Lizanne, it remained as unknowable and frustrating an enigma as when she first set eyes on it in the office of the unfortunate Diran Akiv Kapazin. As yet, despite Macario's efforts, it had signally failed to reveal any clue as to how it might unlock the secrets in Tinkerer's head. She had asked Tekayla to assist, hoping the girl's musical insights might yield some progress, as they had in Jemiah's workshop.
Wrong,
Tekayla said, as Macario finished tapping out another tune on the device's exposed chimes.
I doubt the artisan would have chosen something so ugly. He had far too much taste for that. Try this.
She went on to sing a short melody in her fine, accomplished voice. She seemed oblivious to Macario's baleful stare, which Lizanne fancied was at least a match for the one her father had directed at Tinkerer. The tune was wordless, formed only of notes into something both pleasing and haunting to the ear. It reminded Lizanne of The Leaves of Autumn, the tune that had first caused the solograph's gears to turn in Jemiah's workshop, in feeling rather than composition.
I don't recognize it.
Macario grated when Tekayla fell silent.
You wouldn't, she replied. I made it up. If this infernal thing is powered by music, it will be by a composition from the artisan's era. May I point out, miss, that only one of us is an expert in musical history?
Tekayla made a face and arched an eyebrow at Lizanne.
He's just jealous because I have perfect pitch.
Perfect pitch is just a trick,
Macario stated, bridling as his face darkened further.
I once saw a monkey with perfect pitch in a circus.
Try it,
Lizanne said, before Tekayla could give voice to a no doubt vicious rejoinder.
We've tried every other tune the artisan might have heard in his lifetime, and all they do is cause the levers to turn, which describes the orbits of the three moons, but fails to convey anything actually meaningful. There is more to this thing than just astronomy. It has another secret to tell, and we know the artisan was scrupulous in guarding his secrets. He may well have used a unique composition, one known only to himself.
Macario huffed, but dutifully raised the silver spoon he had borrowed from the officer's mess and tapped out the notes of Tekayla's song on the chimes.
See,
he said, moving back as the tune faded.
A fruitless...
He gave a start as a soft click came from the solograph. It was faint,
but definite evidence that somewhere within the complex array of components that formed the device's innards, something had responded to the tune. Macario immediately repeated the sequence, all animosity replaced by a steady-eyed concentration. This time, however, the solograph failed to respond. "The main theme from The Leaves of Autumn," he said, reaching for pen and paper and scribbling down a series of musical notes. "What else?" "Dance of the Heavens," Takela said. "The second movement. Also the choral melody from The Maiden's Fall." Macario wrote down all the notes from each piece, one beneath the other. "Now your little tune," he said, setting the notes out at the bottom of the page. He stared at it for a moment, then let out a soft laugh. "See it," he said, holding the paper out to Lizanne. Music had never been her subject, and she had only a bored child's understanding of musical notation, so immediately passed the page to Takela. "I don't," she began, after scanning the notes, then frowned as comprehension dawned. "A descending scale," she said. "They all share the same descending scale, but at different tempos." Macario nodded and tapped a series of notes onto the chimes. This time the response was much more prolonged and impressive. All three of the solograph's levers turned at once, moving with more energy than Lizanne had seen before, whilst several of the cogs along its sides spun fast enough to blur. It lasted for no more than 3 seconds, then stopped, after which the solograph emitted a series of notes of its own. It was the same melody Macario had tapped out, but at a much slower tempo, and also followed by several more notes. To Lizanne's ears, the tune possessed much the same melancholy flavor as The Leaves of Autumn, and the other centuries-old tunes the device had so far responded to. She could also tell it was incomplete, the final note cutting off abruptly, as if the solograph had been silenced in mid-conversation. "I do believe we might have made some progress," Macario said. "Perhaps our fellow former inmate can shine some more light on it." "Not yet," Lizanne replied. "I'd rather his energies were concentrated on the new aerostat, for now at least." She nodded at the solograph. "Do you think you can get it to play the whole tune?"
"With time, and," he cast a reluctant glance into Kayla's direction, "some further assistance. Music is a code, after all."
He nodded at the page of notes he had scribbled down.
"At least now we have the beginnings of a key, and thanks to the additional notes it played, a clue as to where to look next."
"So what are you calling this one?"
Lizanne inquired as Jemiah crouched to undo the ties on a canvas-wrapped item on the deck.
"Do you have a new whisper for me? I must say I miss the old one."
He gave a soft grunt, shaking his shaggy head as he stepped back to reveal his latest invention.
"This one doesn't whisper. Could call it the shouter, if you like."
At first glance, it appeared to be a standard-issue Silworth 31 lever-action repeating carbine, albeit modified with a slightly longer barrel and more elaborate fore and rear sights. The wooden stock had also been augmented, with a brass shoulder plate and spring arrangement. However, the strangest modification was that the upper half of the breech mechanism had been replaced by glass instead of the usual iron.
"Something occurred to me during that business in Carvenport," Jemiah began. "Takes a keen eye and a skilled hand to kill a full-grown drake with a firearm. It's one thing for a contractor to do it on a hunt through the interior. Different matter in the midst of a battle. The thumpers and growlers are fine and good, but you need a whole crew to work them. The mini-growler I built in Pharos could do the job, but it eats up a huge amount of ammunition and takes too long to manufacture. If we had a mass-producible small arm that could do the job with only a few shots, seems to me things might go better for us."
Lizanne cast a doubtful gaze over the carbine.
"This can kill a drake?" "Surely can, provided you load it with the right ammunition."
He produced a cartridge from his pocket and tossed it to her. It was about a third longer than a standard carbine round, with a more pointed bullet, featuring a slight indentation at its base. "This isn't steel," she said, touching a finger to the tip of the bullet. Military-grade rounds were usually formed of a lead core surrounded by a hard steel jacket. Jemiah had apparently crafted something new in this one.
"Titanium," he said. "Hard enough to punch through the hide of any drake. Your father had a small stock of it set aside, but couldn't remember what he was going to use it for. He also had some magnesium and mercury. So you have a titanium-tipped projectile which collapses on impact to set off a composite explosive charge. Took a little experimenting, but I think you'll find the results impressive."
He hefted an empty brandy keg the ship's galley no longer had a use for, and made ready to toss it over the side. Bazan bent to retrieve the carbine from the deck, finding it marginally heavier than a standard issue model, but not enough to be unwieldy. She slotted the cartridge into the tubular magazine below the barrel, worked the lever to chamber the round, and put the stock against her shoulder.
"Very well," she said. "Have you ranged the sights?" 50 yards,
Jemiah told her, before heaving the keg into the sea.
"Put some whitewash in to illustrate the effect."
Lazanne stepped to the rail, tracking the keg's progress towards the stern. The viable opportunity was maintaining a slow speed to keep pace with the rest of the convoy, so her target took a moment or two to drift the required distance. When she judged it to be about 50 yards away, she raised the carbine's barrel, centering the fore and rear sights on the bobbing keg. The wind was slight today, so she didn't need to account for it as she exhaled and squeezed the trigger. The sound of the bullets leaving the barrel did indeed resemble a shout, though the recoil was less severe than she might have expected. The stock seemed to pulse against her shoulder instead of the usual hard shove, and the foresight deviated from the target by only a few degrees. Consequently, she had a fine view of the brandy keg as it transformed into a cloud of white vapor. There wasn't even enough left of it to litter the surrounding water with debris.
"One, maybe two to stop an adult green,"
Jemiah mused.
"Three for a red. Blue's a different matter, of course, but you should still be able to do some serious damage. It'll also fire standard rounds if you need to shoot a spoiled."
Lazanne lowered the carbine and ejected the spent cartridge with a smooth motion of the lever, catching it before it could fall to the deck. It was hot, but not enough to burn, and leached a thick, foul-smelling cloud of spent propellant.
"Had to mix a variety of agents to get enough power behind the bullet,"
Jemiah said with an apologetic wince.
"Couldn't make it smokeless."
Lazanne grinned and blew the fumes from the bullet before tossing it over the side.
"Then I'll call it the smoker."
She tapped the glass covering the upper portion of the breech.
"And this?" "That's for an old friend."
He produced another cartridge from his pocket, holding it up for inspection. This projectile was more elongated than those she had used in her whisper, but still recognizable from the viscous liquid she could see inside the glass cylinder.
"Red ball,"
Lazanne said, remembering the various forms of carnage she had inflicted with the product-fueled round.
3 times the range of the pistol version," Jemiah said. "Could only buy enough red to make a dozen, though, so best forgo the test firing, eh?"
She nodded, reaching out to take the cartridge.
"And the explosive rounds?" "Just 30. I had just bought enough magnesium and mercury to make 100, but..."
He trailed off, face darkening.
"Did you see it?" Lazanne asked.
"My aunt."
He shook his head. "It all happened so fast. It was Takela who woke us, told us we had to get in the aerostat and leave. Your aunt didn't believe it, or didn't want to. She went outside to look for herself. Not an easy thing to just fly away from the place you've lived all your life, I suppose.
It's my belief she locked the workshop doors so the drakes couldn't get in when she saw what was happening. Even then.
He paused and gave a sad, helpless shrug.
If your ward hadn't gotten her hands on the mini growler, we'd certainly have shared your aunt's fate.
We'll need more of those before long.
Lizanne hefted the carbine.
And more of these.
Only so much we can do on this tub. Not a lot to work with.
I'll see about rectifying that. In the meantime...
She shouldered the carbine and started towards the ladder to the crew quarters.
I have a long-delayed call to make.
Do you believe it? Clay asked, as the last images of his journey through the world beneath the ice folded back into the grey hues of Nelfia's surface. Lizanne took a long time to reply, absorbing such a quantity of new and incredible information left her own mindscape in an unusual state of disarray. The whirlwinds twisted and entwined with the kind of energy that only came from confusion and indecision. Neither were sensations she enjoyed.
I don't wish to cause offense, Mr. Torkreek, she told him, after managing to straighten some of the more fractious whirlwinds. But I doubt you are capable of constructing memories of such remarkable variety and precision.
Got plenty of wild tales of your own, he observed, and their joined minds shared a brief instant of empathic humor. Bringing down the entire Corvi Empire, quite a feat, miss, even for you.
A house built with rotten timbers on shaky foundations was always bound to fall. My concern is what they'll build in its place.
Think we got more pressing concerns than that. She took a moment to calm her mind yet further, forcing the whirlwinds into a reasonable semblance of order, before sending him a pulse of agreement.
You're certain of this woman's motives? You believe she only wants to help?
I believe she wants to put right what her people did wrong, but I'm pretty sure there's a good deal she hasn't shared yet. I'm hoping I'll get some answers at Crystalline Lake.
Returning to Aratsir at this juncture seems excessively risky. It's likely the entire continent is now under the sway of the White.
Maybe not. It ain't there just now, don't forget. And there are limits to what it can do. Silverpin showed us that. Besides, I'm all out of other options, lest you got something to share.
Tell Captain Heilmore to sail for Verestia. We will join forces.
It was a suggestion that would have carried more weight when spoken aloud, but in the trance she knew he could sense the reluctant insincerity in it. They were both fully aware he would sail to Aratsia, and then journey on to Crystalline Lake, whatever the cost.
Guess that settles it, he observed.
So it seems. However, I feel it would be better if Captain Heilmore stayed with his command this time. Given the fate of the Corventine main battle fleet, he now commands possibly the most advanced warship in the world, an asset we'll need in the days to come.
He'll be hard to convince, not the kind who likes to sit out the big show.
Frame it as an order from me if it helps.
With Pharos gone, I ain't too sure how he'll feel about taking orders, and my influence ain't what it was, but I'll try.
When will you be able to trance again? I'm not sure. The welcome we'll receive in the Red Tides is uncertain, to say the least.
Dealt with a fair few Verestians in my time. They're a practical folk above all else, and they got spies everywhere. They have to know what's been happening, or at least a good deal of it. Could be they don't need as much persuading as you think. Besides which, there's a service you could do me in Verestia.
He went on to explain about Zenida Okanis and her father's connection to whatever lay beneath the waters of Crystalline Lake.
A place called the High Wall, Clay told her. She says he had a pile of maps there. They'll be useful if we're going to find this thing.
I'll see what I can do, Lizanne replied.
She paused, and their shared mindscape took on a darker hue, as the knowledge of what had befallen Pharos struck home once again.
What will you tell your uncle? She asked.
The truth.
think he and Laurie deserved that much. Lines of deep red began to snake through the moon dust, like miniature lava flows. Grief took many forms in the trance. It seemed that in his case, it burned. Looks like we both lost an aunt, huh? And Joya. Was hoping I'd see her again one day. We don't fully know what happened yet, she replied. There may yet be a chance some people escaped. The refugees were ever a resourceful lot. It was scant comfort, something else they both knew, but it was all she had. Where are you now? She asked, happy to alter the topic of conversation. Saw our last iceberg 2 days ago, so a good lick farther north. Captain Heilmore reckons another 2 weeks before we sight Aratia. Would be quicker if we weren't nursemaiding that old blue hunter. They're awful scared of Jack. Makes me nervous. The connection thrummed as Lizanne's blue began to fade. Guess it's time to say our farewells for now, Clay observed. Wait. Lizanne drew one of her whirlwinds closer and formed it into one of his shared memories. The aerostat of marvelous design he had used to escape the world below the ice. I need more images of this, anything you can remember, and anything that woman told you about it. Think you can copy it, huh? He asked, swiftly moving to comply. Nelfia's surface sprouted a new crop of memories, the dust blossoming into a panoply of image and sensation. The Drakes hold a very singular advantage over us, she replied, opening her mind to drink in all the knowledge before the blue ran out. If we can contest the skies, we may have a chance. Chapter 10 Heilmore. They were forced to leave the Dreadfire behind. Heilmore had briefly considered taking her under tow, but that would have required leaving a skeleton crew on board, and they had barely enough hands for the Superior as it was. He took possession of Captain Bledthorn's charts and log, thinking they would be a boon to any historian, especially one with deep pockets. Following a brief solo inspection, to ensure every scrap of anything useful had been removed from the hold, he strode across her deck for what he knew would be the last time. Sorry, old girl, he whispered, running a hand over her timbers before stepping onto the gangplank. I doubt you'd have liked the modern world in any case. It's far too noisy. Sir? Steelfine asked from the other side of the walkway. Nothing, number one. Heilmore crossed to the Superior, gesturing for the gangplank to be removed. Let's get these lines cast off and see her on her way. Could set a fire in her belly, sir, Steelfine suggested. Give her a decent funeral. The King of the Deep's been expecting her, after all. Then he'll have to wait a while longer. Heilmore lingered to watch the old ship slip away from the Superior's port side. The prevailing currents swept southwards in the whirls, and soon the Dreadfire was drawn back into the channel through which she had carried them to safety. Despite her lost masts and many wounds, Heilmore thought she still retained a defiant aspect, as if all the long years in the ice and the recent fury of battle had been unable to dent her pride. Perhaps, he commented to Steelfine. In a century or two, she'll provide a refuge for some other desperate souls. He waited until the Dreadfire had vanished completely into the maze of ice before turning about and striding towards the bridge. Weigh anchor and signal the Farlight to make steam and take the lead. It's only proper since they know the way out. It transpired that Lieutenant Talmont had done an excellent job of clearing a channel through the chokes to the open sea. The young officer had used his stock of explosives wisely, blasting a course through the obstructing ice that was narrow but straight enough to eliminate the need for any tricky maneuvering. Heilmore had ordered Talmont and his small squad back to the Superior, seeing little need to maintain a supervising presence on the Farlight, now their escape route had been secured. In fact, Heilmore nursed a secret hope the Blue Hunter might decide to follow her own course once free of the chokes,
thinking Captain Tidlow and his crew more of an irksome burden than useful allies. But, upon reaching the open sea, the other ship duly fell in behind the Superior, as she set her bows due north. So far, she showed little sign of shirking the warship's protection. Scrimshine, against the odds generated by the growing pool of bets on the possibility of his demise, recovered from his gas-related illness 7 days after the ships cleared the chokes. Having been released from the sickbay on Skaggerhill's advice, he stood in the bridge entrance, swaying a little as he offered Heilmore a clumsy salute.
"Reporting for duty, Skip,"
he began before correcting himself.
"Sir."
Scrimshine's already cadaverous face had been rendered even more gaunt, and his color was pale. However, what distracted Heilmore the most was the fact that the man was wearing a protectorate uniform for the first time since joining the ship. Furthermore, it appeared to have been cleaned and pressed.
"Skipper will do, Mr. Scrimshine," Heilmore told him. "I've grown accustomed to it."
He gestured at the wheel, which had been manned by Talmont for the past week.
"Relieve the lieutenant at the helm, if you please. The heading is north-northeast."
"Aye, sir."
"Mr. Talmont," Heilmore went on, "note for the log. Deckhand Scrimshine hereby promoted to the rank of leading deckhand. Also, awarded a mention in dispatches for his outstanding actions during recent operations."
"Very good, sir."
He saw Scrimshine straighten a little as he took the wheel, but the former smuggler gave no other indication he had heard.
"Heavy cloud ahead, skipper," he said instead.
"Sitting low on the horizon. Looks like we're in for it."
"When aren't we, Mr. Scrimshine?"
This brought a restrained chuckle from the others on the bridge, and a small flare of reassurance in Heilmore's breast. "After all I put them through, they can still laugh," he thought. His good humor, however, evaporated with the arrival of Claydon Tallcreek some minutes later. The blood-blessed's face was as grim as Heilmore had seen it. Beyond him, Braddon Tallcreek held his daughter in a tight embrace, tears streaming down the young gunhand's face, which was for once rendered ugly as she strove to contain her sorrow.
"Tranced with Miss Lethbridge this morning," Clay said. "I got news."
He ordered the news shared with the crew. It may have been wiser to spare their morale by concealing the truth, but Heilmore felt it best to ensure they knew the reality of the situation, however grim it might be. Many crewmen had family in Pharos. It was the largest maritime protectorate base, after all, and the knowledge of its fall left a thick pall of despair over the ship. He kept them distracted with constant drills and much-needed repairs. Prolonged exposure to freezing temperatures had left many of the fittings and armaments in a poor state, in addition to causing much of the ship's paintwork to flake off. The hold yielded a decent stock of paint in various hues, and Heilmore ordered the renewed color scheme to feature both Protectorate Blue and Corventine Green. Although the remaining Corventine crew were small in number, he was keen to emphasize the fact that, despite being a ship of several different allegiances, they had but one common purpose. The possibility of an attack by Blues was a constant worry, albeit alleviated by Clay, who spent most days on the prow in silent communion with Jack. The huge Blue would range out ahead of the ships, his remarkable hearing able to detect his Drake brethren over huge distances. Consequently, they were able to avoid the danger, as Clay related a series of course changes to steer them clear of trouble. However, he also provided a warning.
"He says they're hunting us,"
the Bloodblessed told Heilmore during the evening watch. It was Clay's habit to remain at his post until midnight, before retiring for a few hours' sleep. He sipped the coffee Heilmore had brought him with a tired but grateful grin.
"The White's got 'em scouring the southern seas for us. Ain't sure how it knows what we're about, but it surely does, and it don't like it."
"Can't he..." Heilmore fumbled for the right words. "Talk to the other Blues somehow.
tell them to leave us alone.
He can talk, but they ain't listening. They only got ears for the white. That's how it was centuries ago when it rose before. That's how it is now. To them, Jack's just another enemy in need of killing.
Aylmore inclined his head at the crew quarters.
Has she been any more forthcoming with her intelligence?
Chris, not really.
Seems right fascinated with your ship's library and charts and all. Hard to get her head out of a book just now, though it could be just a ruse to stop me asking questions. Fact is, until we get where we're going, I doubt she'll tell us anything she ain't already.
Land in sight, Captain!
Talmont related from the speaking tube connected to the crow's nest.
Sea and sky reported clear of enemies.
All stop, Aylmore ordered. Talmont promptly relaying the instruction to the engine room via the bridge telegraph.
Drop anchor and signal the Farlight to draw alongside. Tell them I also request Captain Tidlow's presence for a conference.
I put us here, Aylmore said a short while later, tapping a compass needle to a position on the chart laid out on the wardroom table. In addition to Captain Tidlow, he had summoned Zenita, Clay, Braddon and Chris to the conference. Braddon was the only one seated, placing himself at the far end of the table and paying scant attention as he stroked his beard, eyes brooding and distant. Aylmore hadn't heard him speak more than a few words since receiving the news about Pharos, and the man's bearing didn't invite conversation. By contrast, his daughter had been highly vocal in her grief. The night after Clay had related the news that her mother was most likely dead, Lauriabeth had contrived to get drunk on a cask of rum, purloined from the ship's diminishing stores. She spent an hour or more at the stern, raging profanities into the sea air, in between blasting imaginary enemies with her twin revolvers. Aylmore had ordered her left alone, until she became so insensible as to mistake one of the lifeboats for a drake. It was Lieutenant Sigarol who calmed her, grabbing her about the arms and chest as she attempted to reload her guns and put another salvo of bullets into the lifeboat's hull. The Corventine held her as she twisted and spat in his arms, speaking softly into her ear until the rum in her veins finally drew her into an exhausted slump. Sigarol then carried her back to her bunk, staying by her side until morning.
40 miles due south of the Barnahee Firth,
Tidlow said, eyes tracking a westward course over the map.
Which would make Stockholm the nearest port.
We're not going to Stockholm, Aylmore said. He took a pencil and sketched out a route from their current position and into the Firth.
The lower Torquil.
Tidlow frowned as his finger tapped the small inland sea.
That's some tricky sailing, Captain. It's a fractious stretch of water. Small though it may be.
So I've heard, Aylmore agreed. And even trickier when we get to the upper Torquil. Tidlow moved back from the map, shaking his head.
The upper Torquil is said to be richer in aquatic greens than any other place in Aratia. Hardly the safest course in the circumstances, sir.
But our course, nonetheless. Reading the deep uncertainty on Tidlow's face, Aylmore added. One you are not obliged to follow, sir.
What fine choices you give me.
Tidlow let out a sardonic laugh.
Follow you into drake-infested waters, or sail alone to Stockholm in the faint hope there might be someone left alive there to reprovision us.
Aylmore turned to regard Braddon's silent bulk. Your counsel would be welcome, Captain Torcreek. I'd hazard there are few souls who know the Aratian interior better than you do. For a prolonged moment, Braddon didn't respond, continuing to stare into the middle distance until Clay said softly,
Need your help here, Uncle.
The elder Torcreek gave his nephew an impassive glance, then got to his feet, moving to regard the map for several seconds.
Northern flank of the upper Torquil is mostly marshland, he said,
voice flat as he swept a hand over the numerous waterways that characterized the region,
Impassable on foot or boat, except for here.
His finger came to rest on a particular river at the northernmost point of the Upper Torquil.
Quillam River, named for one of the fellows first discovered the Torquils. Current's fierce, but it's the only means of making it to the plains country west of the Crystalline without going through the Copper Souls.
I got no desire to see them again, Clay commented.
The depth of the river?
Almore asked Bratton.
Should accommodate the Superior for about half the way. After that, we'll need a steamboat of some kind to make it the rest of the way. Oars won't do it. The current's too strong.
I'll set Chief Bosware to the task, Islemore said. I'm sure he can rig something up.
Been a while since I commanded a small steam craft. I'm sure I can still remember how.
Clay said, giving a small cough of discomfort. Miss Lethbridge had opinions on this matter, Captain. Thinks it's best you stay with the ship this time.
Islemore stared at him, feeling an icy anger stealing over him.
She thinks that, does she?
He inquired in a low voice.
How very interesting. Says you now command the most advanced warship in the world.
Clay went on with an apologetic shrug.
Probably with all the Corvi ships sunk and all. You and the ship are too valuable an asset to risk. If we don't make it back from the Crystalline, you should sail for Verestia and aid with the defense. Said you can regard it as an order from Exceptional Initiatives, if it helps.
Islemore's anger abruptly switched from icy to hot, and he felt a red flush creep over his cheeks as he leaned forward, meeting Clay's reluctant gaze.
Understand this, Mr. Torcreek. I do not take orders.
He's right, Sunita interrupted. Islemore rounded on her, rage swelling further, then paused at the hard but insistent honesty he saw in her gaze.
This crew didn't follow me, she told him. They followed you, through battle, mutiny, drake fire, ice and deadly gas. You might think I chose to wait for you, but you're wrong. I knew if I had attempted to sail away, they would have hung me from the mainmast and continued to wait until they froze. I cannot command this ship in your absence. That is the simple truth, Sea Brother. You belong here.
Islemore rested his clenched fists on the map, trying to calm the thumping in his temples.
The worst thing about being a captain, Grandfather Racksmith told him once, is recognizing that you're the most important man on the ship, and that's a burden of responsibility few men can stand, for you no longer have the luxury of pride. How will we know if you're successful?
He said, his hard, grating voice breaking what he realized had been a protracted silence.
I can trance with Captain O'Canis, Clay said. Reckon we've been in each other's company long enough for a viable connection. Anything happens to me, and Lieutenant Sigurd can trance in my stead. Anything happens to him, well, we're most likely all dead, and you need to sail for Verestia.
Islemore swallowed, feeling his rage subside into a nauseous anger.
Very well, he said. Assuming you reach the Crystalline, what then?
Chris stepped forward, placing a sheaf of papers on the table. Peering closer, Islemore saw they were mechanical designs, but the device depicted was unfamiliar. It appeared to consist of a large sealed tube attached to a frame, and something that resembled an upended metal fishbowl.
What is that? He asked.
A subaquatic breathing apparatus, Chris said. We'll need to explore the lake bed to locate the aerostat and recover what we need.
You can build this.
She nodded.
There are sufficient materials on board to construct it, but I'll require education in how to operate your welding gear.
The chief will be busy, it seems.
Islemore straightened, breathing deep to banish his anger, though a simmering core of it remained. It was selfish, he knew, born of a desire to see the interior for himself. For all its many dangers,
His time on the ice and the wonders witnessed there had birthed a thirst for more. Perhaps it's in the blood, he mused. Grandfather was an explorer, after all. But this was an active duty warship, and exploration would have to wait for more peaceful days.
We will clear the Firth and enter the Lower Torquil by tomorrow evening, he said. Weather and Drake's permitting, we should reach the mouth of the Quillam River 3 days later. All your mechanicals will need to be complete by then. Let's be about it.
Chief Bosware used the Superior's largest launch as the basis for his steam-powered riverboat. Taking his cue from the Superior's own radical design, he opted for a propeller-driven craft rather than paddles.
Too complex to put together in the time available, sir, he advised Heilmore during a visit to the makeshift workshop on the foredeck.
The chief appeared tired under the usual sheen of oily grime, but the enthusiasm for his task shone through nonetheless. The shaft was a length of iron pole fashioned from a ceiling beam taken from the crew quarters. The propeller had been constructed of copper tubing from the ship's hot water system, the pipes flattened and welded into three identical blades.
With this, it's just two separate components instead of 10.
And the engine? Aylmore inquired. Bosware pulled back the tarpaulin covering a bulky shape in the center of the launch. To Heilmore's eyes, the unveiled contraption resembled a greatly enlarged iron top hat, sprouting from a dense nest of copper and iron tubing.
Luckily, the Corvies had a decent stock of spares for their auxiliary power plant, Bosware said, so the gearing and pipework weren't too difficult. The boiler and condenser were another matter. Had to purloin a good few of Cookie's pots and pans from the galley, plus some deck plates from the hold.
He slapped a hand to the engine, a glimmer of pride evident in his besmirched features.
Reckon she'll do a good 10 knots in calm waters, if she's stoked high enough.
Heilmore turned to where Braddon Torcreek stood, appraising the craft in his now habitual silence.
Will 10 knots suffice, do you think, Captain?
Heilmore asked him.
Braddon shrugged and muttered,
It'll have to.
With that, he stalked off towards the crew quarters. Heilmore had seen men succumb to grief before, crewmates who had learned of the death of loved ones on return to port. Some would lose themselves in drink, others whores or gambling, and a few could be expected to tip themselves over the side during a lonely midnight watch. In Braddon's case, the man neither drank nor gambled, nor showed any inclination to suicide. Instead, when not compelled to take part in a discussion, he sat in his cabin, repeatedly disassembling and cleaning his guns. It's not self-pity that snared this one, Heilmore decided, watching Braddon disappear below decks. It's revenge, which may be worse. The Lower Torquil soon lived up to its reputation for troublesome sailing. Captain Tidlow, having taken a vote amongst those members of his crew not incarcerated in the brig, had opted to stay with the Superior. Both ships sailed through the Barnahee Firth and into the Lower Torquil without incident, finding mostly calm blue waters reflecting the clear sky above. However, the wind stiffened as the day wore on, and the waters soon grew choppy. By late afternoon, they were regularly swept by heavy torrents of rain, and the wind had whipped the inland sea into a minor storm. They were forced to reduce speed, and leading deckhand Scrimshine obliged to work ever harder at the wheel to maintain their heading.
Apparently it's all due to geography, sir,
Lieutenant Talmont commented to Heilmore as they steadied themselves on a pitching bridge.
The prevailing wind comes from the west at this latitude and picks up increased velocity as it passes over the Torquils. It then slams into the natural barrier of the Coppersole Mountains, producing a kind of huge, high-pressure vortex.
Fucking fascinating, that is,
Scrimshine muttered as he hauled on the wheel, low enough for only Heilmore to hear.
Steady, Mr. Scrimshine,
Heilmore snapped, causing the half-grin to vanish from Scrimshine's face. Recently promoted and decorated he may be, but that was no excuse for a lack of respect between ranks.